informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, the Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant? Dare to think out loud. You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded. Dare to think out loud. You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren. Dare to think out loud. You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history. Dare to think out loud. You have tuned in to the right show. Dare to think out loud. Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Well, welcome, everyone, to Dare to Think Out Loud here on the fourth day of March in the year of 2022. And today we're going to approach a rather touchy subject with a lot of people, and that is the title of the program, There Ain't No Magic Bean. Pardon our double negative. But I am joined today, as usual, with my friend from out in western Arizona in the Lake Havasu area. Brother Cal, how are you today? Got to unmute, Cal. There you go.
I had to get the mute button to come up so I could unmute. Well, I'm doing good out here. It's warm, but it's a little bit overcast, and we might get some rain if Scorpio does his rain dance as well in San Diego and sends that rain this way. So we're out here in Arizona, we're counting on you, Scorpio, to send that rain over to us.
Well, speaking of our Southern California rain dancer, Scorp, how you doing today, buddy?
I'm doing okay, guys. And, I think that rain's coming. There's a lot of – it rained all night, so there ought to be something hidden your way.
Well, that will be good for Cal. I'm not sure it'll get all the way to Georgia, though, but I appreciate the idea. Well, one of the things, and Cal and I have discussed it, and I've also discussed it with Dave on many occasions, is the fact that in our history we are so lacking as to the truth of what actually occurred. And I was going to take us back to 1765 to start with. America has just gone through a basically an 11-year war, which is called the French and Indian War. And the King George III, he said, well, you know, gosh, we've just fought an 11-year war over there. Now it's time that I create a way, with the help of Parliament, that we can make these colonials pay for this war. I mean, you know, we fought it for them. They should pay for it. So he came up, and Parliament came up with this wonderful thing called the Stamp Act. At least it was wonderful for them. But one of the things that we have to go back to 1765, one of the things we have to understand is that the wealthy aristocracy in the colonies, in the 13 colonies, had become wealthy through the programs of King George III. In 1765, the wealthy aristocracy did not want a change in government. As that occurred, as Patrick Henry made his proposition of resistance to the Stamp Act in the Virginia House of Burgesses in May of 1765, and Patrick Henry was called a traitor. Treason, they claimed, that he would resist the taxes of King George. Now, the wealthy aristocracy controlled the government back then, just like they control it today. Well, the thing of it was is that the people had reached the point of, you know, what do we call it, the point of saturation with tyranny and taxation, and they had said no more. Well, let's also remember that better than 80% of the population in 1865 were what we would consider today poor or lower middle class, and most of them were agrarian. They were out there busting their butts every day to make enough to keep their families alive. And they were also involved in various trade, what have you, but it was all about survival. But with the wealthy aristocracy, many of whom had come to America, like James Wilson and others who had come to America, and they would become the Federalists, they did not want a revolution against the king. The king was the source of their money. But the passion, because of the majority of the people being the people who were having to pay these taxes, because the majority said, began to go, not no, but hell no, and started making all kind of moves throughout the 13 colonies. Sons of Liberty was born. The Sons of Liberty were not members of the government, standing government of the day. These were the people who were opposed to the standing government of the day. Go back and look, and we talk about Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was happy in Pennsylvania about the Stamp Act because he wanted to be an administrator of the Stamp Act, which would mean that his wealth would be increased by King George. The people who went to the Constitutional Convention in 1787 went there for a specific reason. They wanted to perpetuate a government just like the one which had made them wealthy. They were not the people, in most instances, the people who had fought the battles, like Daniel Shays and Dr. Warren and Crispus Atticus. They were not those people. Those were the common people. There was a caste society, the wealthy and the well-born, and the people who weren't. You know, kind of like today. So the system, suddenly Patrick Henry lights a fire. The word reaches Samuel Adams in Massachusetts. Samuel Adams gets really busy. He loves the contributions of Patrick Henry. And they form the Sons of Liberty. And so the Sons of Liberty spreads to New York. It spreads to other states. And suddenly the wealthy aristocracy is dragged into the Revolutionary War, kicking and screaming. They did not want to go. Because they had to, if to do so, they felt, was to leave their source of wealth and their source of accumulation of wealth. So once they realized that this revolution was in fact going to take place, they needed to hedge their bets. So, yes, they said, oh, all right, you know, and once that separation from England was appearing on the horizon, these people said, we better make some moves. We're the wealthy, we're the well-born, and in letters, there are original documents that will indicate this, and One of them was from George Washington to John Jay in in 1786. Where he talks about how they had a right to impose their imperial dignity on the population of the people, and that the people did not know what was best for them, and that had to be decided by the people in the aristocracy. Does that sound familiar today? Things really haven't changed much. But one of the things that people must learn is that the people who were in the wealthy aristocracy back then were not the revolutionaries. They were the people who had to join by necessity. So then, as soon as freedom and liberty and independence had been secured, the wealthy aristocracy had to go into control mode. They had to control the new government. They were not the common everyday worker or laborer, but they had to control the new government. And they tried to do that with the Articles of Confederation. And in many ways, they accomplished their goals. They were able to take over the government, at least try to take over control of the government, by dominating the Articles of Confederation Congress. Now, today, people, stop and think about that, and you may disagree in some ways, but stop and think about that. What chance does a common, ordinary, everyday worker in this country have of being elected to national office? Slim to none? The same was true back then, and these people intended to dominate. Now, the Articles of Confederation were proposed, but it took 4 years to get them ratified. Proposed in 1777 by the Continental Congress, but it was 1781 in March before they were ratified. So then 1781 comes along, and the Federalists under the Articles of Confederation, the Federalist or the wealthy aristocracy, is controlling the Congress of the people. But there are enough restrictions in the Articles of Confederation that they can't get the complete domination over everything that they want. But one of the first things that happened within a very short time, Maryland ratifies in March of 1781, which brought the Articles of Confederation into effect, and very shortly thereafter, the people who controlled the Congress under the Articles of Confederation turned it right back into a monarchy. And I'm going to let my good friend Cal Robbins go into telling you how in that period of time, how the people put together, how the wealthy aristocracy made themselves a monarchy. And they did so with a gentleman by the name of Robert Morris, someone we very seldom ever hear from anymore. So, Cal, take it away, buddy.
Okay. Well, first I want to interject. Say, you mentioned that the aristocracy was kind of dragged kicking and screaming into the revolution. So let's look at one of them. Let's take George Washington, for example. Was he dragged kicking and screaming? What motivated him to become the general, to volunteer to be the general? Well, it's important to remember that George Washington was a land speculator, and that part of those acts of 1765 through 1775 was the king shut down western lands to the colonists. In other words, he took away the revenue stream. The king did. So that would motivate someone like Washington to say, yeah, I mean, my revenue, you know, is tied up with the king, but the king just took away my source of revenue by tying up these western lands. So it's important to understand that part of the motivation that pushed the Federalists, who became the Federalists, was the king closing down the western lands to expansion. You couldn't go west of the Appalachian Mountains. So part of all of the aristocracy's involvement was just over land grabs. They were just basically carpetbaggers, and the king had stopped them from doing that. But I'll digress, and we'll go back up to Robert Morris and the creation of the Bank of North America. And as Mike stated, the Articles of Confederation were approved by the Continental Congress on November 15th, 1777. Now, this is what about, let's see, July 6th, 1776, July 4th, I mean, 1776, when they declared independence. So we're roughly a year and a half later, they have this, okay, we've had this form of government proposed. They weren't actually ratified until Maryland was the last state to ratify, I believe it was Maryland, on March 1st, 1781. So we're looking at 3.5 years almost later that the Articles are actually ratified. In the meantime, this war is going on, and by 1781, it's becoming more and more apparent that the colonists, or the states now that they call themselves, are going to win this war. It's becoming more and more apparent that they're going to win this war, and they've done so without any centralized government. They've just done it as rough states. Well, so the Articles are ratified on March 1st. And going through source documents, there's an interesting letter from Alexander Hamilton. Yeah, his name's popping up already, that he wrote to Robert Morris. And it's talking about how – now, remember, Hamilton, he's a bastard child from down in Haiti, basically. And he's now the aide-de-camp to George Washington. And he writes in a letter, and I'm going to read this. It says, I have been in a situation that has enabled me to obtain a better idea of this than most. He's talking about finances. This better idea is how are finances to be done. And I venture to assert that the court of France will never give half the successors or half the loans to this country while Congress holds reins of administration in its hands. In other words, France is, you know, if Congress is holding the reins of administration, they're, you know, France is used to a monarchy. They're not quite sure about this. They might not be as apt to loan the money as if, which, if they're just to the Continental Congress. So he says, the court of France will never give half the successors to this country while Congress holds the reins of administration in their own hands, which they would grant if those were entrusted to individuals of established reputation and conspicuously for probability, abilities, and fortune. So in other words, somehow this aide-de-camp, this bastard child who's really a nobody back then, he's just aide-de-camp to Washington, has this better insight onto how banking systems work. You know, it's like, okay, my question is, how does he know? And that's one of the questions Mike and I have been searching for. Where is this? What is this about Hamilton that he knew about this? But anyway, he's writing this letter to Morris and saying that he is recommending to Congress, and he's just aide-de-camp, he's just nobody, writing to Congress saying, well, you need to make Robert Morris in charge of finances. Lo and behold, on April 6th, or no, yeah, May 6th, the not Continental Congress, now it's a Confederated Congress. You got to remember, we've gone from one quasi form of government to an official form of government called the Confederated Congress. And on May 6, 1781, they granted a charter for the creation of the bank, and they placed Robert Morris, head of finances, in charge of this. Now, I don't know if this recommendation from Hamilton had anything to do with it, but either way, Robert Morris is made the head of it. And Robert Morris, in agreeing to take this position, basically puts down a whole bunch of conditions on it where he is essentially the dictator or king. I mean, everything has to go through him, all decisions. He basically gets to make the final decision. He has ultimate veto. He has the ultimate say. Congress can say what they want, but hey, he holds the purse strings. So basically, he's in control. So within 2 months of creating the Articles of Confederation, the Congress, that Congress controlled by the Federalists already, has already set up a monarch or a dictator. So that tells you something about the Articles of Confederation. And while the Articles did stop them from being able to do some things, they still set up, you know, Robert Morse as the head of it. So Robert Morse sets up this bank. And how does he capitalize it? Well, he tries to get enough people to invest in it, but he can't raise the money. He needed, I believe it was like $500,000 to begin this bank, and he could only raise like $140,000 from investors. So he's way shy. But lo and behold, along about this time, France sends over a loan to the Continental Congress, as opposed to what Hamilton had said, France is loaning the money to the Congress. Maybe because they know Morris is in charge. I don't know. I haven't researched it that much. Either way, Morris takes, there's a $462,000 loan in gold and silver or specie. And Robert Morris takes $254,000 of that money to finish capitalizing the Bank of North America. And to capitalize it, he loans this money out to his friends and cohorts, his fellow Federalists, on the condition that they take that money and turn around and reinvest it back into the Bank of North America, and thus capitalizing the Bank of North America, and their return as shareholders is whatever the interest money is that comes in. And that's the first loan. Now, Mike has mentioned another $18 million later loaned by France to the continent, to the Confederated Congress, and Sentinel, in his essays, mentioned $17 million, so we're $1 million off. But there's another $17 to $18 million that's unaccounted for that goes into the Bank of North America. And the first thing Robert Morris does is once his bank is capitalized, because he gets it up and running, oh, it's up and running by the January 7th, 1782, the bank begins its operations, and immediately Morris starts loaning money to the Congress from the Bank of North America, not from France. In other words, the Congress and the people who got to pay all this loan back, which is the taxpayers and future taxpayers, have to pay the interest to the bank and the shareholders and pay the money back in interest to France, plus, you know, the principal. But by now, banks are starting to figure out that we're not so interested in getting the principal paid back. As long as they're paying the interest, we're making money. And that's the whole central banking scheme set up way back in 1699 by Robert Patterson with the Bank of England, Mike? Am I correct on that date?
1684.
This is just a continuation of it. Which starts to make you wonder, wait a minute, who's really in charge here? Because, you know, England and France still aren't getting along. France is supporting the colonies or the United States, whatever you want call them at that time, because they haven't fully gained independence. So the banks are kind of like, we'll loan money to anybody. We'll play both sides because we'll make money. We'll make interest on both sides. And the shareholders will make interest on both sides. So now we get a look at who are these shareholders of the bank? Who are these people who are going to profit from the blood and treasure spent by the normal everyday colonist, citizen, whatever you want to call them, of the colonies or the states? Well, that would be the shareholders. And who are they? Well, most of the domestic ones, well, they're all shareholders in the Bank of North America. George Washington, he's making money on this war. So even though in 1781 it was pretty sure that the war was going to be won fairly soon, they actually, I can't quite prove it, but I'm sure Mike's got some info on it, they actually extended the war and made it last longer so that they could continue to make money off of the war through interest. And hope that encapsulates what the Bank of North America was and what it did, and that these monies were never accounted for, and that with the Constitution of 1787, through the ex pro facto clause of the Constitution, there's no way for the government or the people to ever recover that money that was embezzled by Robert Morris and his cohorts. Does that sum it up pretty good, Mike?
Very well, Cal. And I think it's important that the people understand that about, and again, Gouverneur Morris, who was Robert Morris's assistant, and remember that name, he's very influential in the Constitution. Gouverneur Morris and Haim Salomon, who is from the synagogue of Philadelphia, who is a money changer, and he is the representative, he is the liaison between Robert Morris and France on these millions of dollars that get transferred. Now, suddenly, somewhere, the people begin to catch on to this about 1785 because Morris and both Morrises have extended the idea that the war is still going on from Yorktown for almost 2 years. As you succinctly said, Cal, to make the people think that the war is still happening and that therefore loans still need to be made, all of this other stuff needs to be happening. But the people in the various states are beginning to catch on to this. And number one, if you look at source documents, they are saying among themselves, well, no, I'm not paying any state taxes anymore. I'm not going to do this because my state taxes are going to pay interest on loans to France and then also paying these bankers. We're paying double interest. Go ahead, Cal.
Well, it's interesting with Haim Salomon because this money that, you know, in specie that France loaned to the United States directly led to the French Revolution because those loans bankrupted France. In other words, France borrowed the money to lend the money to the United States. So is that where Haim Salomon comes in?
Well, I think so.
King Louis didn't have that much gold to just give to the United States because, you know, he hated England and wanted England to be defeated. They borrowed the money. This is why France later on, you know, after the revolution called in the States General Council so that the crown and the nobility could figure out how the heck they're going to pay this loan back. Because France was going bankrupt because of the money it loaned to the colonists or to the states. So that would seem to me be an indicator of why Haim Salomon was a liaison between the two. Because France didn't have the money, but apparently Haim Salomon, who he apparently somehow did or had access to it. So where does, one more question, who was it France owed the money to? Who was it that France owed the money to that created the French Revolution?
Well, Cal, let's not forget that the source, the thing that was happening within the Bank of North America was what we refer to today as fractional reserve banking. Morris was loaning out to the United States as the principal much more money than they had on deposit. He loaned up to four times the amount they had, which meant that if you loan money you don't have, you're collecting interest on money you didn't have to start with. So the stockholders are getting immensely wealthy from this fractional reserve banking that Robert Morris has created. Now, just to make it simple for Bubas here, Cal, if I come in and I say, here, Cal, I'm going to let you have $1,000. And so you take that $1,000 and you loan out $1,000,000. And therefore, you're collecting interest on $1,000,000 when all you had in the beginning was $1,000. Now, that's an oversimplification, but that's what was happening with the Bank of North America. And the people, you know, who were majority just people just trying to make a living, just trying to keep their families fed, in 1785, through this period of time, they're beginning to go, hey, there's something wrong with this system. Well, also under the Articles of Confederation, which is controlled by the Federalist, the wealthy aristocracy, just like today, the wealthy aristocracy controls our government. So back then, they're going, hey, the people in the various states have quit paying their taxes. We have to have a way to compel them to pay their taxes, but we can't call it that, so we must call it a government of more energy. So there was a financial crisis going on in the colonies, which was created by this Bank of North America, just like today we have a financial crisis created by the Federal Reserve. This was just on a smaller scale back then. So we have this happening. We have, and it's, you know, the people are saying no, not no, but hell no. So the Federalists controlling the Congress figure out, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to create some tax schemes to where we can compel these states to pay their taxes, which means they are paying our interest on money that was created out of nothing. And so the people are going, no, no, we're not going to do that. And so they tried on multiple occasions to get tax bills through, but Article 13 of the Articles of Confederation was their stumbling block, because it meant that every state had to agree to this. All 13 states had to agree to being taxed, and they wouldn't do it. There was always holdouts. Nope, I ain't going along with this. So in 1785, these Federalists, these stockholders in the Bank of North America said, look, we need to have a meeting. Let's meet at George Washington's place down there at Mount Vernon, and let's figure out how we can create a government of more energy, which can compel the people to pay the taxes so our income is secure. Well, that, you know, wasn't working. The people kept fighting against it. So then the Federalists decide we need Washington, because we tried the Annapolis Convention 1786. It did not work. We only got five states to show up. It did not work. We found out we need Washington to give us validity. He's the national hero. We need him there. And they even put his name on the list that he was going to be at the Constitutional Convention even before he agreed to do so, because they knew to have the validity at that Constitutional Convention. The 1787 Constitutional Convention was a revolution against the revolution that had been won previously. Wow, that was cute. Where'd that come from?
Sorry, Mike, that was my phone.
Oh. Oh, that's cute, Dave. I like that ringtone.
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful.
My ringtone is Burning Georgia Down. Dave, you've been fairly quiet here for this period of presentation by Cal and myself. What are your thoughts, sir?
Well, yeah, my phone did all the talking there. You know, the thing that's coming to my mind really is that we're seeing that essentially fractional reserve banking is nothing more than legalized criminality, and it is the genesis of so many problems that you guys are talking about here. You know, without fractional reserve banking, so much of the shenanigans would be a lot more difficult to pull off. And if you or I tried to lend out, you know, 10 times more money than we actually have, we'd be in jail. So it really is legalized criminality.
Well, and that is why that anti-federalist Samuel Bryan, who wrote a Sentinel, that's exactly what he called it. A criminal conspiracy. That is why the Constitution was formed. Now, the people who went to Philadelphia, who were selected to go to Philadelphia. Those who were there went there with one distinct purpose, at least the hierarchy went there with one distinct purpose in mind, to create a government which would ensure that they would always be paid the money that they demanded and that they could force the American public to pay those taxes to ensure that they were paid. And you will find that in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. The very first power given to Congress was the power of unlimited taxation. The states, and several states, would not collect taxes to support this scheme, so that system under the Articles of Confederation had to be destroyed, and it had to be changed. And by damn, they got it done with the Constitution. Now, we go into many thoughts on that creation of that Constitution. And so we look at, again, so many things. So one of the things I thought about was this. And this happened at the Constitutional Convention, but I want you to think about that. St. Thomas of Aquinas said many centuries before this that if men abandoned the idea of God as the supreme good, they would tend to replace him by the idea that material wealth is the supreme good. Now, I'm going to make an allegation here that a lot of people aren't going to like. But what the Constitution of 1787 did is to implement that program. Because they did away with Article 6, Paragraph 3, they did away with any oath to the Christian faith. But not only that, to any oath to any other faith. And what they demanded was an oath to the Constitution, which they had just created. That is why Samuel Bryan said that they would wrap the Constitution in the cloaks of divinity. The Constitution of the United States changed the people's God from the God of their individual choice to the God called government. And everything they composed into that, as was delineated on multiple occasions by people such as Richard Henry Lee, Patrick Henry, William Grayson, Samuel Bryan, Luther Martin, the things they incorporated into that Constitution was the ability to take any efforts by the people to change it and to make sure that they had every door covered, that there was no escaping this Constitution of more energy. Thoughts, Cal?
Well, one only has to look to 1860, 1861 to realize that, yeah, you can't escape this Constitution. The states tried. States tried. They couldn't do it. Look at anybody who stands up and tries to be individual or separatist, so-called, so to speak. The Randy Weavers of the world. What happens to you if you don't want to play this game? What does this government do? What does this government do to other countries around the world who don't want to play the U.S. hegemony game? It's just, the evidence is out there and it's overwhelming if people would just look and see it. You can see this government for the evil that it is. And when you study history and go back to the source documents, you can see the evil that created this government, that was motivated not by money, but by the love of money. And that's what created this government.
And what does the Bible say about the love of money?
That's true evil.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, that the people, the Federalists created this government out of love of money. I mean, they were going to make money off of money they didn't even have by making interest. And the other thing is people need to understand that any form of debt, if I owe Mike, if I borrow $100 from you, I'm in debt to you, and I owe you the equivalent of however I pay you back, you know, through the fruits of my labor, that money back to you. But you own $100 worth of the fruits of my labor. So when the government borrows money and puts everybody in here on the hook for the debt, because that's what the Constitution says, they are enslaving everybody to the central bankers. And the central bankers get to call the shots because, well, they control the money. And that's kind of what Samuel Patterson said, isn't it? Well, that's the whole theme behind centralized banking, is to control the people.
Well,
can't be about the money because they can print whatever money they want. So it's really not about the money. It's really not even about the interest on the debt anymore. It's about the illusion that there's this debt. And because you owe this debt, you are under control. And if you're under the control of someone else, you are a slave of that someone else. And so the central banks have not just enslaved people in America, they've pretty much enslaved all of humanity now.
Well, Cal,
from its start in 1684 till now, they've pretty much enslaved all of humanity. Stand up against it like Gaddafi did. What happens? Say no like Iran does. What happens? You become the enemy, don't you? The evidence is out there. People just want to look at it. Well, sorry, Mark. I didn't mean to step on you.
If we go to, the recent, happenings in the Ukraine, let's look what happened in 2014 when Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, and John McCain go to the Ukraine and tell the people there, look, you either depose this man that you elected who supports Russia. You either depose him or we will remove billions of dollars from your IMF funding. Overrule the will of the people, a duly elected chairman. Depose him because we don't like him or we will take away your money. That, I think, is a graphic illustration, Cal. But one of the things I would like to also point out is that socialism has a long history, but it was only accepted by the Western establishment, meaning America, when God was purged and it became an ideology of atoms in the void. Prior to that, the American government was all about agrarian and pro-family. Then it changed. It went from agrarian and pro-family to socialism, and the Constitution of 1787 is abject socialism. People, you can't fix it with a magic bean. They did not write something into that Constitution to allow you to overthrow it and their power. It's not there. And people who believe, and Cal, I'd really like for you to go into this, if you would, please, sir. People who believe that this country was just absolutely hunky-dory until Abraham Lincoln came along in 1861. Cal, would you branch out on that for a while, sir?
Well, it was sometime during the Jefferson administration, I believe about 1803. A bunch of senators got together in a closed door session and were just, the northern states wanted to secede. They said, this isn't working. There's too much diversity amongst us. This needs to be split up before it's forced to split up through blood and treasure. They hadn't quite figured out that we'll make money if there's a war too, but they didn't want to do that. So there was before, and we're talking, just after the turn of the 19th century, the beginning of the 1800s, there was already talk of secession, which means there was already problems with whatever this Constitution created. This government wasn't quite working how they said it would. And I just want to express this for all the people who think all the problems came from the Civil War from 1861 on, through the 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th Amendment. I just want to point out, those southern states wanted to secede before any of that, before any of those amendments. They were still wanting to secede and tried to, but weren't allowed to because, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and if the Congress thinks that they shouldn't secede, they don't get to secede. They don't have rights. They're not sovereign. They have whatever privileges the federal government, or better yet, the United States, which is a corporation, decides that they have.
When do you guys think that?
Sorry, Dave.
When do you guys think the first, you know, desire for secession actually began within the southern states?
1833.
Oh, wow.
There was a huge argument, and I believe Andrew Jackson was president at the time, and Jackson said he would not allow the states to secede. He would invade South Carolina if it chose to secede. There was a classic argument in the U.S. Senate between Daniel Webster, and it's escaping me right now. Anyway, they've torn down his statues everywhere. There was one classic. That thing lasted for 3 days in the U.S. Senate. People, if you have never read that, read it. But that is John C. Calhoun. That is who it was. I'm sorry. It took this old brain for a minute to process that information. But John C. Calhoun and Daniel Webster had a classic battle about this. South Carolina was going to secede because the North was taxing them to death, and they didn't have the votes to stop it. And for all of you people who think that, and Cal, what a wonderful point, that the South wanted to secede not because of the 14th Amendment, but well before it. And that's why these, peddlers out there of all kind of magic beans today are saying, well, you know, we've got to fix it because the 14th Amendment destroyed it. Yeah, bullshit. It is not that way, people. Let's go back to the government had only been in existence for about 10 years till the Sedition Act of 1798 came along, which made it a crime, a federal crime, to criticize your own government. Does that sound fine to you? That happened in 1798.
And it sounds like what's going on now.
Yeah, 10 years in, it was a crime. And then in the Supreme Court, when one of the gentlemen who had criticized the U.S. government, when he was tried in federal court, a Supreme Court justice, Samuel Chase, said from the bench to the jury, it makes no difference if what they said about the government is true or not. The fact that they said it is a crime. That's 10 years into this government, people. That was many years before Abraham Lincoln was even a twinkle in his father's eye. That's how corrupt this thing was from the very beginning. And look at what John Marshall did in the Supreme Court long before Abraham Lincoln was there. Look at all of his decisions that were totally unconstitutional. What was there to stop it then? Look at Marbury v. Madison, 1803. Look at McCulloch versus Maryland in 1819. Look at those decisions. Look at what created the 11th Amendment. What was it? Chisholm v. Georgia. Look at that decision. This government was not fine until Abraham Lincoln came along, people. There are no magic beans to fix it. Cal, help me out here before I get apoplectic.
I just wanted to point out that, well, you can take the risk of rebellion and you can see George Washington asserting his imperial dignity and commanding obedience, just like he wrote to John Jay, can't you? he was president,
absolutely.
But basically
great,
he was the king
point.
On his horse. He was the king on his horse leading, these supporters against these tax rebellers.
Violating Article 4, Section 4.
Yeah,
he was violating his own constitution that he had helped write. He was violating it 3 years later. Thanks, Cal. I didn't mean to step on you.
No, that's fine. He had two different opinions, one from John Jay and one from Marshall. And John Jay said, no, you shouldn't be able to do that. And Marshall said, yeah, you should. Well, so you just look for the right answer you want, and, you know, you can assert your imperial dignity and command obedience because that's what's necessary and proper for the general welfare of the United States.
Yep.
So there's justified. But that's also despotism and tyranny. So despotism and tyranny has been constitutionalized, basically. Because the government can do whatever the heck it wants. It's a government of implied powers. And that's the words of Madison. Not mine. Madison. Father of the Constitution. He's the one that said that this government can't be held to express powers. That it must be operated under powers of implication.
Absolutely.
So how is that not... The government, the federal government, the United States, whatever you want to call it, because really it's a corporation, it can be as despotic as it chooses to be. People say that, well, they couldn't tax the people directly until the 16th Amendment. No, they didn't choose to tax the people directly. You remove the 16th Amendment and the government still has the power to tax the people unlimited and directly. And that power didn't exist under the Articles of Confederation. In fact, the federal government, the Confederated Congress, had absolutely no jurisdiction over the individual of any state whatsoever. None. The federal government couldn't do anything to any individual. A point that Patrick Henry pointed out in one of his speeches at the ratification conventions.
Well,
the federal government should be able to hold the states accountable because, well, the state can't be thrown in jail. But now with this direct taxation, they now have jurisdiction over the people. And if a person doesn't want to pay their taxes, such as the Whiskey Rebellion people, they can be prosecuted for it, where that couldn't happen under the Articles, which is, look at Shays' Rebellion. That would be evident of it.
Well, a great example there, Cal. Absolutely fantastic. Is the fact that the Constitution transferred the federal government's authority from that of being one over the states to that of one over the individuals. That made slaves out of every person in this country, and to those unborn to this day, they are born into slavery under this Constitution, and you can't find part of the Constitution. You believe for a second that there is a remedy in something that you can fix when that entire document was written to be broken. I am so tired of the magic bean people. So tired of, if we'll just do this, the government that made us slaves created an escape door that we can use if we're just smart enough. Yeah, tell that to the millions, the hundreds of thousands of people in prison in this country for victimless crimes. Tell me how well that's worked, will you please?
Are you talking about the 10th Amendment type people?
Some of those. They are just really cute, right?
What part of the Civil War happened did they not understand? The Civil War itself, the mere fact that a state tried to exercise a sovereignty that it thought it had, that it had actually surrendered when it acceded to the Constitution, what part of this are you not understanding? The states only have rights, let's call them privileges. The federal government, let's not even federal government, let's call it the United States, allows them to have. And as long as they play along, they're fine. But the states are vassals of the United States. They're not independent and sovereign. As Richard Henry Lee said, they should be in the Lee Resolution. And as Thomas Jefferson said, they should be and are going to be in the Declaration of Independence. So Constitution is a revolution against it.
Cal and Dave, let me throw something out here before the end of this first hour. And that is the Constitution of 1787 was a revolution against the Declaration of Independence. Prove me wrong.
I totally agree. It was intended to be.
Your thoughts, Dave?
Well, Mike, I think your supposition about, you know, the giant loopholes intentionally written into the Constitution are just, you know, it's hard to argue against it once you really look into it, Mike. And, you know, we're just seeing that play out over and over and over again.
Well, Richard Henry Lee wrote in a letter to Patrick Henry in September of 1789, and he said that the people here, the Federalists, look at the people's rights as a miser would look at a note. And that they want to make sure. And he said, and William Grayson wrote to Patrick Henry, people talk about their Bill of Rights. You have no Bill of Rights. William Grayson said to Patrick Henry, we are worse off with them than we were before. Meaning under the Articles of Confederation. And yes, Jennifer, thanks for that comment there. And that is exactly true, is that Alexander Hamilton stipulated at the Constitutional Convention that he wanted to create with the Constitution a federal empire. That is what they have. They have it today. You can't fix it, people, with a magic bean. They did not give you an escape hatch in the Constitution. I promise you. No one who builds a slave pen puts a hole behind a building so those who want out can escape. It's just not done. It's just not there. Cal, finish us out for this hour, please, sir.
Well, the grand point of all that is as long as people keep, you know, being parchment worshipers or believing that this Constitution does have some kind of magic being hidden within it, the people will remain enslaved. The system itself was built to do this. It's a guillotine, people. You pull the rope and the blade comes down. That's what it does. They build a guillotine, and it doesn't matter who pulls the rope, the blade comes down. Or they build a machine gun, it doesn't matter what priest you put on the trigger, he pulls the trigger, and the bullets come out the gun, and people die. People suffer, and people die. And this is all to the advantage of the wealthy and well-born, or the aristocracy. And yeah, they'll throw table scraps out at you to keep you happy. Lots of bread and circuses out there to keep people entertained and distracted. And I guess people are happy in their servitude.
All right, guys, we'll be back on the flip side. Thanks for tuning in to Dare to Think Out Loud.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Interested in the paranormal, murder mystery, real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's Ivan, thank you. Welcome to the Crypt.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for free association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
That's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Well, welcome back, folks, to Dare to Think Out Loud. And in America today, you can leave off the second part of that phrase. You can say just dare to think, boobus. You might be really, really surprised at what happens when you actually think instead of feel. Well, Cal, one of the things I was thinking about while we were on break there was that gentleman from the North Carolina Ratification Convention by the name of Harry Abbott. Are you familiar with him?
Not too familiar, no. I've heard the name, but not too familiar.
All right, well, Harry Abbott looked at Article 6, Paragraph 3 or Clause 3, whatever we want to call it, of the Constitution when it was being ratified in the state of North Carolina, which it was not at that convention. They rejected it. But Harry Abbott made a very succinct observation about Article 6, paragraph or clause 3, the one that did away with the Christian oath to the Constitution. And Harry Abbott said, and I quote, "There will come a time in this country when our government will be inhabited with infidels, non-believers, and Muslims." Was he right, Cal?
Well, yeah, considering there are infidels, non-Christians and Muslims in positions in government, yeah.
How did he know?
Well, because those people too want to have power and be in charge of others. It's not just Christians that want to control other people. There's other people in other religions, and some religions are less scrupulous than the Christian religion, who also want to be in charge of other people. I don't know. These people who want to be in government, who want to work for government. I mean, I understand some people, they think they're in there to serve, but the majority, especially the most influential, they're there to be in control. They have a mindset that they know better and that they need to be in control of other people. I can't wrap my mind I'm not that way, so I can't wrap my mind around it, but I understand that there are people that's their modus operandi in life. They get off on controlling other people. They revel in it. They get joy out of it. They get joy out of making people dance. They get joy out of wearing two masks, even though they know it doesn't do any good. They do it for shits and giggles. That's how they operate. That's how their minds think.
Well, Cal, here I'm going to make this statement, and I know I've made it before. It makes people angry, and that means I'm doing something right. Because if you make boobas happy, you are playing into the game. So the only way that you know that you're doing what should be done is when boobas gets upset at you. But I'm going to say it right here, people, and there is no remedy for what we are facing to be found in the Constitution and Bill of Rights of the United States. If we are ever to be a free people, then there has to be a new construct. There is no freedom to be found in that Constitution and that Bill of Rights. Cal, prove me wrong.
No, I totally agree. I mean, how many people out there, how many Abubas could explain the difference between a federation and a nation? How many understand the difference between the two? They call this United States a nation. Well, yeah, it is. But that's not the intent of those so-called founders that drafted the Declaration of Independence and later wrote the Articles of Confederation, which were both done by the Second Continental Congress. Different people in that body of men, but that body of men had a purpose, and they stuck kind of pretty much to that purpose the best they could, I guess, with the articles. But the Constitution itself is a revolution against the principles of the Declaration of Independence. And the Declaration of Independence is what lays out the founding principles of what people think America should be. But people say America and they think of the 50 states, where if you lived in Virginia, Virginia was your country. They didn't see this big continuous conglomerate of states stuck together. They saw them as independent nations in league with each other. And that's just something people today need to wrap their mind around, because that's the direction things have got to go. If you want to be free, you've got to decentralize this monster. You've got to remove the centralization of power and disseminate that power as best you can back down to the people. When you centralize power, people lose power. If you decentralize power, the individual gains power. It's a give and take. It's a seesaw effect. For every cause, there's an equal in action. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. It all fits the laws of nature, the laws of physics, and fits within inside the understanding of rightful liberty.
Yeah, very well said. Dave, you're kind of gone quiet on us. Has the rain got you in California?
No, it's letting up now. I think Cal made a great point about decentralization of power. that's the only way forward. You're thinking that this federal government is going to be reformed in any way, to me, is just naive. And it's going to go round and round on the merry-go-round that we've been on for the last, let's say 100 years, certainly. And, this federal government is truly the enemy of the people now. And we're going to see that in earnest as they try to shoehorn us into a war that has nothing to do with America.
Well, that is really good. Dave, that's a really good thought, and especially one of the things that I like to do, and you are totally aware of this, I know Cal is that I like to bring history of 250 years ago into actually what's happening in our world today. And if we can draw that conclusion, maybe we can bring more people in. One of the things that we know is that the media is owned and controlled by the deep state. We will know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false. CIA director, 1982. We own every one of any importance in the major media. CIA director, I believe that was Casey that said that. Anyway, it was another CIA director. So they tell you they own the media, and you still believe them. And that, to me, is incredible. I mentioned to someone this morning, the people who tell you how bad Russia is and what they're doing in the Ukraine are believing the same people who told them that 2 weeks will flatten the curve and that Biden was elected president in 2020. Why do people believe a convicted liar? Help me out there, Dave. Why does that happen?
Well, I think the game is to get people running on emotion, and that's what they're doing now. You know, all this kind of reminds me of the incubator baby stories right before the invasion of Iraq. It's interesting how the media is just focusing on all the babies being born in the subway station and, all the suffering of the citizens, which, is certainly valid in a war. But that, of course, you have to put it into context because it's after 20 years, if not a single word of civilian suffering for these Middle East wars that we've been involved in for really no good reason. And of course, essentially the carpet bombing of Baghdad, shock and awe, which was just, sort of a sales campaign to get Americans to go along with that.
Well, it is incredible. It certainly is. But Dave and Cal, help me out here. Most Americans want to depend on this Constitution and Bill of Rights by what they believe it says, not what history proves that it was written for, but they want to believe it because of what it says. I mean, Article 5 of the Constitution says that you have the right, to the rule of law. Do you? It's not there. And then if you do not study, and, of course, Cal, you and I talked about this earlier. I had a critic, who was coming at me about the 10th Amendment earlier this week, who was saying, well, we can fix everything with the 10th Amendment. Everything is there that can – the 10th Amendment is there. And I asked him, first off, he was a retired Army colonel. I said, well, Colonel, have you ever heard of Thomas Tudor Tucker? Well, hell no. Who was that? Well, okay, have you ever heard of Agnes Burke? No! What damn difference does that make? I said, well, have you ever heard of Richard Henry Lee? He said, you mean Robert E. Lee? I rest my case. Cal, would you address that, please?
Well, would you bring up... not Burke. Who was it that Madison was debating with over the 10th Amendment out of North Carolina? Tucker, Thomas Tudor Tucker. I mean, when Madison said that this is a government of implication, that was in a debate over the 10th Amendment, people. They were debating the 10th Amendment when Madison said we can't have the word expressly because this government needs to be a government of implied powers. So I don't know where people get this government is of express powers other than it was actually James Wilson, I believe, he said it in his courtyard speech, because both Madison and Hamilton never said it was expressive powers. Madison said the powers were few and defined. He didn't say they were expressly delegated powers. He specifically stayed away from that phraseology in the Federalist Papers. And so did Hamilton, because they knew they would get slammed if they'd have said that. So Madison used few and defined, and somehow people have taken that to mean expressly delegated powers. But you only need Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, along with Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, and Article 6, Clause 2. You can take those three few and defined powers and create any government of despotism that you wish. Those are delegated powers, delegated to the United States. And those few and defined powers have set up the potential for all forms of despotism and tyranny. And there's nothing people can do to change that other than to remove the entire form of government and replace it with something if you think that it needs to be replaced with something or not. Does that say it pretty good, Mike?
Fairly well. You know, I've had the question, especially that gentleman, he was all about the 10th Amendment. Everything can be fixed, you know, and he fails to understand by the questions that I ask him that in the first Congress, there was the argument which you alluded to, or the debate between Thomas Tudor Tucker and Aedanus Burke, actually jumped in on that a couple of times, too. They asked the question, you know, about the word expressly delegated. And of course, as you alluded to, Cal, very adroitly, that Madison said, well, we can't limit the government to its expressly delegated powers. What? There must be powers of implication. Well, if you give anything implied powers that aren't listed, you've opened Pandora's box. There is no end to the powers that that entity will claim it has if you say it can have implied powers. What was it Jefferson said? We must chain this government down. How do you chain a government down? You can't do it with the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that was written, and especially, you know, that Madison made sure that the word expressly wasn't used, expressly delegated powers. Well, Richard Henry Lee in the first Senate tried to put the word thereof, tried to add it at the end of the 10th Amendment, and he was voted down unanimously. The 10th Amendment says the powers delegated to the people of the states or the people. The people as defined by the U.S. Senate in 1789 was the people in aggregate. That's all of the people. That the 10th Amendment does not mean the people of that state. Richard Henry Lee tried to get that added with the word thereof, the people thereof the states. And Richard Henry Lee, in a letter to Patrick Henry, said the lawyers have written and misconstrued and used their verbiage to make anything legal that the government intends to do. And what was it Thomas Jefferson said about lawyers, Cal?
About lawyers or about laws? The law is often the tyrant's will.
Yes.
So the rule of law is often just but the tyrant's will.
Well, does that cover that Article 5 thing of, well, you know, we have the rule of law?
Yeah, well, you have the rule. You have the tyrant's will.
Well, the law says you're a slave. You may not be a physical slave, but you are a fiscal slave. Not physical, but F-I-S-C-A-L. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1 makes you a fiscal slave to this government. There is no escape hatch. There's no magic bean. There's no super umbrella. There is no parachute to avoid. You can't run off to another country and claim you have the answer and try to sell it to people who still live in the country.
Oh, you mean by changing their citizenship status? The government, you know, I mean, the courts, you know, get the final say and they're the supreme law. So the courts get to define what a citizen is, don't they? And they did. And the court says that the citizen, and the court says the citizen is the same thing as a subject. So a citizen of the United States is no different than a subject of the crown.
Well, Cal, who has the final say about what is and what is not constitutional in America?
The court.
In
practice, the Supreme Court in practice.
Okay, well then the people have no say so, right? Is there a jury for the Supreme Court?
One time only.
Didn't quite go
the way they wanted, so they haven't had one since. And that was that Georgia versus Brailford you mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Does the Supreme Court sit a jury, and do they argue the case in front of a jury of the people, by the people, for the people? Do they argue that case before a jury and the people decide, or does the government have the final say-so?
The government has the final say-so.
And that is in the Constitution, am I correct?
Yeah. The Federalists put it there on purpose. And they wrote the Article 3 vague enough, because they knew that they would control the Congress, that they could create whatever they wanted to, because it was written so vague in Article 3, whatever they wanted to in the first Congress, or first, second, third, whatever. Whichever Congresses they wanted to, they can shape it. Because, well, they delegated to themselves the power to create law, to do whatever they think, whatever they decide for themselves is necessary and proper for the general welfare of the United States. Not to decide whatever, you know, necessary and proper to secure the liberty of the people, but to decide what's best for the general welfare of the United States. And you need to understand when they say that, they're talking about this corporation that the people, meaning the Federalists, created.
Well, Cal, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, once he was enlightened by Jefferson for a while, and then he went right back to being a Federalist. But Madison agreed with Jefferson that the final arbiter of what is and what is not constitutional in this country is to be found not in the courts, but in the people by the way of the jury, both Pettit and Grand. And, of course, we know this federal government has taken over both juries. The federal government controls the grand jury. The federal government controls, or the state governments. There are a lot of state governments that don't even have a grand jury. Cal, have you got Article 5 of the Constitution in front of you at the moment, sir?
Not in front of me, but I can pull it up real quick. Well, that just brings up a question in my mind, though, is why do the people even allow the government to be in control of the court system at all, the juries? Why did they allow that?
Well, look at how many times that has been used. Look at how many times that has been used. The government can investigate itself, and then it declares its own verdict on itself.
That's not a conflict of interest at all, is it?
No, well, don't forget
that's not fair.
Don't forget that the wonderful John Danforth did a thorough investigation of Waco.
Oh, yeah.
And let's not forget that the Warren Commission did a thorough investigation of JFK assassination. Let's not forget that the 9/11 Commission did a thorough investigation of 9/11 and never mentioned World Trade Center Building Number 7 in their entire damn report.
So what you're saying is we investigated ourselves and we found no wrongdoing.
Well, we have investigated ourselves and found that we are completely innocent. Cal, yep. Think about that 9/11 Commission. Who did George W. Bush, the shrub, who did he want to make the commissioner over the 9/11 Commission, but it just got too much
flack?
Yeah, that's a good word. I was going to use something else, but that works good. I was trying to find a word that was presentable for Revolution Radio. Who did he want to make put in control of the 9/11 Commission?
I'm not sure. I guess he probably wanted someone like Kissinger.
I don't know. Exactly. Ding, ding, ding.
Was that
ding,
a
ding,
good,
ding,
that
ding.
Was a guess. That was just a guess at looking at how government operates. Yeah, that would make sense that he would want that.
Way to go, Cal. You get your choice of teddy bears.
Oh.
Hey, Dave, jump in here and help Cal and I from our insanity. Will you please?
Well, what aspect do you want me to comment on, Mike?
Well, Cal and I are losing our minds because we don't believe that the federal government will ever hold itself accountable for any damn thing that it does. Please help us out in our period of insanity here. We need some kind of intervention. Could you help us out, please, sir?
Well, the Warren Commission was a very thorough investigation as well. Looked very deep into the assassination and came up with, guess what, the official story. And I'm sure that the 9/11 Commission not mentioning World Trade Center 7 is just an oversight. The corruption is just for all to see. And, I don't see, again, any way to reform this. That's a pipe dream. So we're going to have to look to other means of governance. And I'd like to know why do we need this federal government at all? What function does it really serve other than to force a centralized agenda upon all the states? I mean, the states have more power than they need. Quite frankly, so what is the function of this federal government? What do we need it for?
Well, wait a minute, Dave. My goodness, we have to have the military. We have to have a military to execute the commands of the international bankers. I mean, yeah. If we are going to have any justice in this country, if we want the oil in the Middle East, we must have a military to blast them to hell so that they will give us up their resources. And if we want to take over the Ukraine, we have to have a military sitting there with nuclear missiles to threaten Russia. And if we are going to have justice in this country, we have to have the military, to invade Iraq because Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11. I mean, come on, Dave. What the hell's the matter with you, boy?
Well, wasn't there some warning about having a standing army somewhere in the distant past?
Ooh, Patrick Henry. He was very, very – he said, we shall have a standing army to execute the tyranny of government. Ooh.
Yeah.
And, guys –
So, Mike, I think, you're doing such a great job of just showing that so many of our belief systems were just built upon a false premise to begin with. And until that false premise is removed, we're just going to go round and round on the hamster cage. Or the hamster wheel, essentially.
Well, Dave, you brought up the Warren Commission, buddy, and you shouldn't have done that because I got to jump in on that. Have you ever read the complete Warren Commission report?
No, I have not. I can only imagine what's in it.
Well, I'm a freaking idiot. So I've read it two or three times.
Wow.
One of the things, as a matter of fact, I ordered it when it was first available. And it was sent to me. I paid for it so I could actually have a copy of the Warren Commission report. And I got that, I think, in 68 or 69. I've had it and I still have it. And one of the things that amazed me, guys, is who did JFK fire as director of the CIA?
Dulles.
Alan Dulles. Exactly right. Cal, ding, 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 you get another Cupid doll. So there we have it. There we have, okay, but who is the guy who literally, and you have to read it, people, who literally took control of the Warren Commission? Alan Dulles.
Dulles.
Anytime anyone began to bring up contradictory evidence against the state, meaning the government, against the government's rendition of 9/11, anyone who brought up relevant information was immediately overridden by Alan Dulles. And Alan Dulles had been actually kicked out by FDR and I'm sorry, JFK. And JFK said he wanted to tear the CIA up into a million pieces and cast it to the wind. He saw what was controlling our government, and it was not the elected officials.
Yeah, and, you know, if there was ever, like, a number one suspect to be involved in the Kennedy assassination, it had to be Alan Dulles, yet somehow he found his way to be on the Warren Commission. I mean, it's really amazing when you think about it.
Well, Dave,
who appointed the members of the Warren Commission?
LBJ. And not only LBJ. And not only was Dulles there, but Dulles, guys, until you read it, until you see how every time someone started to delve into an avenue that was contrary to the, like I remember specifically some questioning of the people who did the autopsy of JFK. They were being questioned by counsel. Suddenly, who jumps up and starts railing on about something that was totally irrelevant to the moment, but Alan Dulles?
Mike, and, you know, I've read a couple of books about the Dulles brothers, and according to quite a few reliable, you know, people, Alan Dulles continued to run the CIA, you know, de facto, even after he was ousted. You know, agents going to his house to get orders and get, you know, their next assignment directly at Alan Dulles' house, which was located on Q Street in Washington, D.C.
Imagine that. And that is exactly true. And the good old L. Fletcher Prouty mentioned that in the secret team. And that is something, you know, the president fires the head of the CIA, but he secretly still runs the CIA. Who's in charge, people? Do you really think the people you vote for are the people who control this government? Nah, ain't going to happen. But until you read the actual transcript of the Warren Commission and see how many times it was obvious, if you read it, how many times Alan Dulles interrupted any, you know, they were talking about the Cuba connection. Whoop, whoop, Alan Dulles jumps in. They were talking about the fact that the rifle that our good friend, you know, the assassinator, was the rifle that he held up in a picture was not the rifle that was found in the Texas School Book Depository. Who jumps in and obfuscates the conversation? Alan Dulles. Lee Harvey Oswald, when they started talking about things that Lee Harvey Oswald had said, including his last telephone conversation, people, which is very, very, very intuitive, who jumps in and totally obfuscates the questions? Alan Dulles. Why was he allowed to do that?
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting too, Mike, you know, when the OSS, you know, the predecessor of the CIA, was first formed, it was actually located at Rockefeller Center, and Alan Dulles actually was working there for some time. So what's interesting is this connection between, you know, big banking cabal families and the intelligence agencies is what I see.
Well, who created the CIA, guys?
Wild Bill Donovan.
Well, he created the OSS, but
right.
What president Truman. Made the CIA?
Truman.
Yeah.
Okay, after the Kennedy assassination, did Truman have anything to say about the CIA?
I think, didn't he say it was the biggest mistake he'd ever made or something like that?
Right along those lines. Gentlemen, why was the what is the mission statement of the CIA? The CIA is not authorized by government, by its own charter, to be involved in all of the stuff it's involved in. The CIA, think about it, Central Intelligence Agency. The CIA was chartered in 1947 to be the central collector of intelligence. They were not to be operators. They were not to go out and influence countries. They were not to do all of this stuff. All of this stuff happened under Allen Dulles. Of course, in Vietnam, I remember we referred to the CIA as Christians in Action. So, and the CIA has, I had a bumper sticker on my truck when I was at the National Security Agency, and I was ordered to remove it because I had a bumper sticker on my truck that said, "Dare to keep the CIA out of drugs."
Yeah, you know, I'm currently reading, the book Compromise by Terry Reid, and, you know, boy, if that book doesn't prove the premise of your bumper sticker, I don't know what does.
Well, in Vietnam, the CIA had a secret organization called Air America. Those of us who were there at the time called it Air Nuoc Mom. And, of course, Nuoc Mom is the Vietnamese fish sauce. That is what we referred to it. And that was their drug running operation between Laos, Cambodia, and the U.S., and the CIA at that time was actually shipping drugs home to the United States, secreted in the coffins of those who had been killed in action. The international drug trade is controlled by the CIA, and they use the profit from that to run all of their black operations, which aren't listed anywhere. So, Cal, you've been silent too long, buddy. Wake up. Go to work here. Tell us what you think.
No, I mean, well, the CIA was involved in Iran-Contra. I mean, there's all kinds of reports out of it, how the CIA was behind all of that. And not only that, it puts, you know, Governor Clinton, he was involved in it. In fact, they actually had a nickname for him because, you know, the President of the United States was called POTUS, and they called the nickname for Clinton, you know, Governor Clinton was Goofus. He was considered governor of the United States because that's how he acted and behaved.
So, well, let's not forget the CIA.
Bushes were involved, both senior and Jeb Bush is mentioned. I mean, Jeb Bush set up hits. Mueller, he's listed. I mean, Oliver North, all these names were involved in Iran-Contra. A drug running operation of the CIA.
Well, let's not forget that the CIA was involved they involved both the Bush family and the Clinton family in a huge drug operation, which was operated out of MENA, Arkansas. Now, Bubas, I'm sure, has never heard of this. And if you want a really good insight to that, folks, I would highly recommend you read a book called Boys on the Tracks. A very good insight. And so the CIA has been involved in drugs, and that's one of the reasons people aren't going to like this, and I really don't give a damn. But one of the reasons we invaded Afghanistan after 9/11 is because the Taliban had almost dried up the flow of opium into the United States, and that had to be stopped. You can't allow those nasty towel heads to stop your opium production. And people, whether you want to believe it or not, the United States military went into Afghanistan and guarded the poppy fields.
Right. And Mike, wouldn't you say the CIA's involvement in drugs maybe began with the so-called French connection?
Ooh, a great connection there, Dave. Hey, beep, 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 beep. You get a Cupid doll, too. Yep, today's a wonderful day. I'm giving out Cupid dolls and teddy bears. And and both my esteemed colleagues here have won at least a Cupid bear or a Cupid or a teddy bear. Ooh, there we go. All right, guys. Cal, kind of rescue us here. Where are we going on the magic bean issue here? Especially when we stop and consider that I believe, and I believe there's evidence to prove that, which can be found in a book called Target Patton, that both the NKVD, the precursor to the, you know, the wonderful KGB, and the OSS, the precursor to the CIA, were, there was a joint operation to where they took out a true American hero by the name of General George S. Patton. Thoughts, Cal?
Well, no, that there's a book out there that's called The Forgotten 500, and it's about the rescue of American airmen who mostly bomber crews who went down in the area of Crimea, and in that area it was held. One side was controlled by Stalin, and that was the Tito regime, and Mogadishu, something like that. And the other one was another, you know, freedom fighter that was, you know, more controlled by themselves, but the OSS, influenced by MI6, was leaning towards the Tito regime and helping them out, except for in this one operation where Mogadishu, I can't remember his name off the top of my head. It's one of those names like that. But he actually helped rescue over 500 downed American aircrew out of that area, right underneath the nose of the Nazis during that time. But during the whole time, the support was supposed to be for Tito, who was a puppet of Stalin. And so, yeah, you're starting to see that, you know, that influence already, even during World War II.
Well, Cal and Dave, I have said in articles as long ago as 20 years ago that the largest criminal enterprise in the history of this country was the United States government. Can you refute my posit? Dave, you go first.
Well, I don't think I can refute your posit, Mike. you know, history bears that out all the way. And it really is a criminal enterprise, you know, on so many different levels, not just the CIA, not just the intelligence agencies. You know, you look at now at how, you know, almost every Congress critter may not enter Congress as a millionaire, but they all leave as millionaires. So it's really becomes, you know, a business, and they're all feathering their own nests. And there's no other way to describe it other than a criminal enterprise on so many different levels, Mike.
Well, before we go to Cal, I would like to bring up an incident of my own personal knowledge. In 2010, I lived in the southwest region of Colorado, and there was a congressman elected in 2010 to the U.S. Congress. And at the time of his election, he listed in his personal finances a net wealth of $2.1 million. Now, the majority of that money had come from his father and his actual legal business enterprises. But here this good congressman had a declared wealth of $2.1 million. Some 13 months later, at a town hall meeting in the congressman's region, I was there, and I asked, when it came to question and answer time, I raised my hand, I was recognized, and I said, Scott, when you ran for office a mere 13 months ago, your net worth was listed at $2.3 million, depending on assets. And I said, now your net worth is $11.3 million. Would you please explain to the people here today how you jumped from $2 million net worth to $11 million in 11 months or 13 months as a U.S. member of the U.S. Congress when your pay is $150,000 or $175,000 a year? Would you explain that for me, please? And, of course, my question was quickly dismissed. And he went on to the next person who raised their hand. So let me tell you that people who get into this, when you elect someone into the United States government, you are putting someone into organized crime. And they are going to profit greatly from organized crime. That has been proven over and over. Of course, a short time after my question was asked, I was involved in a serious automobile accident I was on my Harley Davidson, and I was traveling down the highway, and I had a person turn in front of me with a truck and a trailer, turn left in front of me, and I went down on the highway at about 55 to 60 miles per hour. So then any time after that, I appeared at the good congressman's committee or townhouse meetings or town hall meetings, my questions were never accepted. Any thoughts on that, gentlemen? Cal, while you're looking at your ceiling fan?
No, actually, I was taking notes.
Just kidding.
Well, no. You said that the United States government is the largest criminal enterprise. And I would posit that the largest criminal enterprise is actually the central banks. It's the largest criminal enterprise this world has ever known. And the United States government is probably its largest subsidiary. But, you know, you could place pretty much all the rest of the governments of the world as other subsidiaries of the central banks. And you can add into that the military industrial complex, big pharma, big agra. These are all just subsidiaries or corporations controlled and run pretty much basically by the central banks, just like the government is run by the central banks. And that's why you see such an ease of, call it what it is, fascism, you know, corporation and state, such a relationship between the two, because it all is the advantage of the central banksters. So yeah, my posit would be that the central bank and the banksters in charge are the largest criminal enterprise the world has ever known or seen. By far, because they pretty much control the world. Look around out there. How many countries ended up having to wear a mask? That wasn't just here in the United States. That was worldwide. That's a lot of influence, people. That's a lot of power.
Well, Cal, I have no evidence to offer in refutation of your point, because the international bankers obviously are the deep state.
Yes.
And one of the things people do not understand, especially in the states, that those of you who scream about your 10th Amendment rights, I would tell you that in each state, there is a member of that governor's cabinet who is a deep state operative. And for those of you who doubt it, contact me. I believe I can show you your deep state operative operating within your own government. And that is at the state level. These people are thorough. They make damn sure. And I was just talking with a former senator from the state of, a state senator from the state of Arkansas on the phone yesterday morning. And in 2017, he and a fellow senator at the time were awarded and honored by an organization in Arkansas. They were honored and awarded as the people, the two senators in the Arkansas state government who most clearly honored the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the state of Arkansas. Well, almost immediately, they were targeted for by their own Republican Party. They were targeted for loss in their next election. One of them, a gentleman I spoke to yesterday morning on the phone recently, and the other one, Miss Linda Collins Smith, for those of you who would like to look it up on the internet, was killed in her yard, allegedly by one of her campaign people, one of the biggest cover-ups in the history of the state of Arkansas. All right, move along. Cal, help me out here, buddy.
It's back to that old adage, follow the money. You want to know where the corruption is, follow the money. But like I say, the United States government is a subsidiary of the banksters. And when people cling to the Constitution or they vote for more representatives or do anything to support this government, they are supporting the criminal enterprise. There's just no way of getting around it. And how does one extract themselves from it? Any way that you think you can. In any way possible, you know, don't use the government. Don't vote for, don't play their game. I mean, it's one of those things where the only way to win the game is not play the game. The only way you're going to win Vegas is not to go to Vegas. It's the only way you're going to beat the house is don't go in the house. Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, Mike, I have a question. How big, you were talking about Arkansas. How big do you think the Rockefeller influence has been, you know, in Arkansas, having lived there yourself?
Oh, you mean Bill Rockefeller? Oh, I'm sorry, Bill Clinton?
Yeah.
Yes, he didn't get there by accident, people. I promise you that. You go down to Hope, Arkansas, where Bill Clinton's mother lived at the time. And you look into the influence at that time of a Rockefeller, I believe there is evidence there that Bill Clinton was fathered by a Rockefeller. Of course, you know, just like Alexander Hamilton, we don't use the real lineage there because, hey, we might give something away, so we can't do that. The depth of control, even at the state level, Dave, is incredible. And, of course, the wonderful Linda Collins Smith, I met with her on several occasions, had dinner with her on occasions, the former senator, a beautiful lady, and she truly wanted to do what was right. She was fighting as a senator against implied immunity, which meant that cops could do whatever the hell they wanted to with impunity. She was also fighting against seizure of assets without a criminal conviction. She was also fighting so hard against children being taken from their parents by the Child Protective Services and then later being exploited by people, these children. That was her passion. A beautiful lady. She sincerely was a beautiful lady. I enjoyed our conversations. I enjoyed the times we met for dinner. I really liked this woman. And they found her stabbed to death in her own yard. And of course, we had a fiasco. Of course, number one, the state of Arkansas had to declare everything mute. There could be no discussions of the trial. And then they put some lady in prison for life who was a part of her campaign. And she was said to be the killer for nefarious reasons. But regardless of the fact, if you challenge this machine, they're going to come after you, baby. I promise you. I have several examples myself. Dave?
Wow. So she was found stabbed to death in her yard?
Yes, and wrapped up in a tarpaulin.
And was anyone ever charged in this?
Yes, there was a member of her her reelection staff, her campaign staff, was charged and is now serving a life sentence for killing her in a situation to where everything involved in that case was censored by the state of Arkansas.
Wow.
Censored for 50 years? Like they normally do?
Well, probably, you know, but if you throw in the attention span of Bubas, you know, you can suspend actual facts for 15 minutes. Bubas won't know anything after that because there's probably a ball game on TV or cars going real fast in a circle. But regardless, guys, here we have talked about there ain't no magic bean. We are rapidly approaching the end of our program. And gosh, guys, I truly have enjoyed this. Dave, would you briefly tell the people how they can support Revolution Radio?
Sure, Mike. Well, you know, Revolution Radio is fully funded by listeners. So if you guys out there are enjoying this incredible history lesson that Mike Gaddy has been giving y'all, step aboard and help keep this station going, because, you know, there ain't nothing for free in this world, as they say. So come aboard freedomslips.com. That's freedomslips.com or revolution.radio, and become a Patreon member. Or scroll down to the bottom of the front page there, and there's a way you can mail in money the old-fashioned way. Or you can go to the Zazzle store and buy some cool gear for very reasonable prices as well. So take your pick, but step aboard and help this train keep it going, because as we all know, we are in the age of censorship.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate that. Folks, and if you are mentally ill or otherwise disposed and you want to keep up with the Rebel Madman, you can do so at several Telegram channels, one of which being Teach Me True History, the other is the Rebel Madman, and the other is Constitutional Fraud. And I'm working on my new internet program, pardon me, called RebelMadman.org. And there is the music. Folks, thanks for tuning in to Dare to Think Out Loud. Cal, David, love you guys. Thanks so very much. Folks, have a wonderful week.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
The
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Zero five one seven three.
We talk about decentralization and that.